Welcome back to Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis. The National Marine Fisheries Service said earlier this month it intends to propose rules for protecting threatened West Coast salmon and steelhead in four western states. The proposed regulations, known as 4D rules from the section of the Endangered Species Act that authorizes their use, will protect salmon and steelhead in California, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. However, exemptions would be available for a range of activities from scientific research to commercial and sport fishing. Unfortunately, they might include logging and road building plans as well. The rules are in response to the listing of 14 fish populations as threatened. They will prohibit anyone from harming protected fish or their habitat. These proposals constitute a major innovation in the Endangered Species Act program and will be good for the fish and good for the public, said William Steele, head of the National Marine Fisheries Service Northwest Region in Seattle. By creating powerful incentives for local programs in place of federal take rules, we hope to broaden the scope of those conservation efforts and provide local governments with the option of going with homegrown solutions. The draft rules would let the National Marine Fisheries Service allow limited harm to listed species for otherwise lawful acts so long as specific guidelines are followed to protect the overall health of the populations and their habitat. These guidelines are designed to complement efforts underway within each of the four states to protect salmon and steelhead and their habitats. Our customary approach to protecting salmon, said Steele, has been to issue broad boilerplate 4D rules that provide protection for fish, but they provided no place for local programs in lieu of those rules. People who wanted protection to take from take prohibitions were required to obtain permits on a permit-by-permit basis. If these rules become final, restrictions would be placed on activities that could harm the listed fish or their habitat, such as overfishing, poor hatchery practices, or developments that degrade water and habitat quality. But Steele could not say what specific activities would be prohibited, demonstrating that significant questions remain regarding how the rules might be applied. Unavailable or inadequate data leaves a high degree of uncertainty about who will be affected, reads a partial draft of the rule. The National Marine Fisheries Service is soliciting comments on the proposal for the next 60 days. The agency will also hold public hearings in Idaho, Washington, Oregon, and California during January and February to gather comments. If you'd like additional information, contact the following number, 1-877-725-6669. That's 877-725-6669. Or go online to www.nwr.noaa.gov. That's www.nwr.noaa.gov. And a federal judge has ordered the United States Fish and Wildlife Service to identify and protect habitat for the threatened California red-legged frog. The order came as a result of a lawsuit filed by five conservation groups concerned about the frog's decline and the continuing destruction of its delicate habitat throughout California. The California red-legged frog is the largest native frog in the western United States. They inhabited the Sierra Nevada mountains up to about 4,500 feet and could be found in Shasta County in Northern California all the way to the northwestern Baja California in Mexico. Today, however, they are extinct over 70% of this former range, and their numbers in the remaining areas have plummeted. The frog is completely eliminated from the Central Valley and Southern California areas. Reasonably healthy populations can only be found in a few isolated areas along the coast, and a few stragglers hang on in the Sierra Nevada range. The court criticized the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for failing to recognize the benefits of critical habitat designation for the frog. Quote, the designation would itself inform the public as well as state and local governments about locations and habitat needs of imperiled species, where the public is educated as to the location and specific habitat needs of imperiled species at risk. Inadvertent acts of destruction may be avoided. The court rejected the service's effort to reconsider, on its own extended schedule, its decision not to designate critical habitat. The court stated, quote, the service has had ample opportunity to reevaluate its decision of its own accord. Now it must do so by order of this court. Quote, the ruling will help prevent the extinction of the frog in the Sierra Nevada. Red-legged frogs were once found in creeks and ponds up and down the range, and we want to make sure that this famous frog is once again as common as it was in the days of Mark Twain, said Deanna Spooner with the Pacific Rivers Council. And since 1996, the Fish and Wildlife Service has not once designated critical habitat without being sued, added Earth Justice Legal Defense Fund attorney Jan Hasselman, who represented the plaintiffs in the lawsuit. While we are relieved that Twain's frog will finally receive the attention it deserves, the service's rigid and illegal hostility to habitat protection has to stop. If you want more information, contact Deanna Spooner of the Pacific Rivers Council. Her number 510-548-3887. That's 510-548-3887. Or how about David of the Responsible Consumers of the Monterey Peninsula, 831-624-6500. That's 831-624-6500. And ask for David. A rare tropical rainforest where reproduction of trees is intricately linked to the arrival of El Nino weather phenomenon faces imminent death due to logging and human intensified climate change. The loss of the forest, located on the island of Borneo and regarded as a unique ecosystem, could put a huge dent in the global economy. Timber exports contribute $8 billion annually to the Indonesian economy and provide 80% of the plywood used in the United States home building industry. Degradation of dipterocarp forest will have repercussions in both Bornean terrestrial ecosystems and in regional economies with global implications in as yet unforeseen ways, researchers led by ecologist Lisa Curran at the University of Michigan wrote in the December 10th issue of Science. Dipterocarps are the main family of rainforest canopy trees in Indonesian Borneo. The trees synchronize their reproduction, called masting, to the onset of the El Nino Southern Oscillation, which occurs about once every 4 years. Climatic conditions of an El Nino year triggers simultaneous fruiting in the dipterocarps and are essential for regional seed production, she says. It's like Thanksgiving in the forest. Wild boar, orangutans, parakeets, jungle fowl, partridges, and other animals congregate to stuff themselves. Local villagers collect baskets of seeds called ilipi, sea nuts, to sell as a cash crop. Yet, since so much seed is produced, there is still enough left over to germinate and produce a carpet of new seedlings. The problem, researchers discovered, is that intensive logging on the island around the Gunung Palung National Park over the past decade has reduced seed production from 175 pounds per acre in 1991 to just 16.5 pounds per acre in 1998, even though 1998 was a major El Nino year. According to the research, logging appears to reduce the local density and biomass of mature trees, reduces the spatial extent of masting, and alters the forest's response to El Nino by disrupting soil conditions or causing extended drought stress. Even though the park is supposedly off-limits to logging, the forest is losing the ability to regenerate itself, said Curran. Seed predators who cannot find food outside the park are moving inside the park to eat the dipterocarp seeds before they germinate. In 1998, the scenario worsened when massive forest fires on nearby logging plantations destroyed an area the size of Costa Rica, brought pollution and intensified El Nino drought, killing the few remaining dipterocarp seedlings. It's very sad, but unless the Indonesian government implements sustainable forestry practices, creates financial incentives to harvest responsibly, and prevents clearing and burning for industrial plantations, this ecosystem will be unable to recover, according to Curran. And from British Columbia, the December 20th issue of Time magazine names the campaign to protect the Great Bear Rainforest as the number one environmental issue on the planet for 1999. The Great Bear Rainforest took up the top spot over population growth, Florida's Everglades, global warming, and panda bear conservation. In recognizing the global importance of the Great Bear Rainforest, Time stated, "You don't have to be a conservationist to know trees that have stood tall for centuries should not be cut down to make paper and bookshelves." That's why environmental groups rallied this year to protect British Columbia's Great Bear Rainforest. The story listing the Great Barrier Rainforest as the number one environmental issue features a photographic image of a spirit bear along a salmon stream taken by Rainforest Conservation Society campaigner and award-winning photographer author Ian McAllister. Raincoast has been working to protect the Great Barrier Rainforest for a decade. And the West Virginia Highlands Conservancy has filed a lawsuit against the West Virginia Governor Cecil Underwood and State Division of Natural Resources Director John Rader for failing to protect the public lands of the state of West Virginia in Blackwater Falls State Park. The Conservancy claims that Underwood and Rader, who chairs the Public Land Corporation, are violating state law by granting right-of-way to Allegheny Wood Products through the Blackwater Falls State Park. The right-of-way leads to both AWP's new timbering job plan for this winter and also to its proposed condominium sites on the north rim of the canyon. The right-of-way that Cecil Underwood wants to give to John Creets, Allegheny Wood Products owner, smacks of cronyism. It is illegal and is not in the best interests of the people of West Virginia, said Judy Rod, co-chair of Conservancy's Blackwater Committee. Rod explains that the roadway would go through a fragile part of the park within sight of several scenic overlooks and the park lodge. She notes that the right-of-way also provides for sewer, electric, and water lines. The suit alleges that Underwood is attempting to rewrite deeds 45 years after they were issued and has not followed the procedures outlined in the Public Land Corporation for the sale and transfer of public lands. The Conservancy maintains that the original easement granted to West Virginia Power and Light Transmission Company at the time the park was created does not allow an easement across property on the canyon rim. The West Virginia Public Lands Corporation, which holds the deeds for all West Virginia public lands, is also named as a defendant in the suit. And here's hoping that the Aspen City Council has started a trend that will rapidly sweep across the state and nation. In a 5-0 vote last week, the council approved a resolution that calls upon Congress to act expeditiously to stabilize the United States population. It specifically backs a new immigration legislation that would roll back the number of annual arrivals to 175,000, a figure that, the resolution says, represents the traditional replacement rate. Nor is that all. The resolution calls for environmental responsibility and asks that protection for workers' wages and benefits be included in all free trade agreements. It backs enforcement of existing immigration laws as a way of reducing illegal immigration. The ultimate goal, the council said, is an improved quality of life for U.S. towns and cities, including Aspen. The city council's proposals are significant and represent a departure from normal politics in recent years. The United States has taken in about 1 million new people each year, more when the full impact of illegal immigration is taken into account. It is estimated that at current rates of immigration, both legal and illegal, the nation's population will reach 450 million in the next 50 years. That works out to about 175 million more people than we have now. And more than two-thirds of the new arrivals will be immigrants or their descendants. Aspen is not alone in their concern. Several cities and counties in Florida have also spoken out on immigration issues recently. The cities were motivated by the fact that existing zoning in Florida would allow for a total eventual population of 101 million. This is 7 times the current population of Florida, about 15 million. The root cause of all environmental problems are too many people. Moving to Arizona, in two decisions issued on November 24th and November 30th, the Interior Board of Land Appeals affirmed decisions by the Bureau of Land Management to authorize a hobby rancher to use a bulldozer to reconstruct long-abandoned jeep roads in and around Peebles Canyon in the Arastra Mountain Wilderness in western Arizona. One of the abandoned roads that will be reconstructed leads to a private inholding at the bottom of Peebles Canyon. The others lead to abandoned livestock water developments on 3 sides of Peebles Canyon. The decisions also authorize the rancher to use a backhoe within the wilderness to reconstruct all of these water developments, some of which were abandoned so long ago that no traces of them are currently visible. Peebles Canyon is the centerpiece of the Arastra Mountain Wilderness and is arguably the single most famous feature in any Arizona BLM wilderness. Arizona Highways magazine has described Peebles Canyon as one of the wonders of public land in Arizona. BLM environmental impact statements have described Peebles Canyon as, quote, a rare and lush riparian habitat in the midst of a rugged desert, and as having exceptional wilderness values, and as an example of the rarest and most productive wildlife habitat in western Arizona. A BLM booklet describes Peebles Canyon as uniquely pristine. The state of Arizona has classified the stream in Peebles Canyon as a unique water, a designation reserved for water bodies that are of, quote, exceptional recreational or ecological significance because of their unique attributes. The BLM decisions affirmed by the Interior Board of Land Appeals will have a devastating impact on the wilderness qualities of Peebles Canyon and the Arastra Mountain Wilderness. According to the BLM's own environmental assessment, reconstruction of the abandoned road in Peebles Canyon will require major and extensive earth moving on a steep slope within the canyon. According to some environmentalists, According to the same environmental assessment, this work and the subsequent motor vehicle use will create a motor vehicle route within Peebles Canyon that would look maintained and appear to casual observers as a road receiving regular and continuous use, will create long-term and permanent visual impacts in Peebles Canyon that will violate the BLM's management standards for wilderness, and may cause the raptors for which Peebles Canyon is famous, including peregrine falcons, to be forced off their nests during nesting season by the presence and disturbance of humans and vehicles, and to abandon the area as a nesting site for tracks less exposed to human activity. And for further information, contact Joe Feller of the Arizona State University in Tempe, Arizona. His number, 480-965-3964. That's 480-965-3964. Or you can contact him at joseph.feller, F-E-L-L-E-R, at asu.edu. That's joseph.feller at asu.edu. In other Arizona news, is the Grand Canyon a natural wonder or an amusement park? Indeed, this richly ironic alert from the Wilderness Society asked the question in the context of promoting a wilderness plan for the park, but it comes on the heels of public hearings held in the last few days in Flagstaff for the controversial Canyon Forest Village, a development proposal which TWS publicly supports. The Colorado Forest Village is accused of being, among other things, an amusement park masquerading as a museum, with an artificial river trip and a Stairmaster treadmill designed to stimulate the climb up the Bright Angel Trail. Canyon Forest Village is being touted by the Wilderness Society and other prominent environmental groups as, quote, a showcase of sustainable development and a, quote, model for national park gateways across the country, unquote. Other groups endorsing the project include the National Resources Defense Council, Scenic America, and the National Trust for Historic Preservation, the Environmental Defense Fund, the Grand Canyon Trust, National Parks and Conservation Association, Global Environmental Options, and the American Rivers. The FFL-CIO and a group called Native Americans for Community Action have also come out in favor of the proposal. In other Arizona news, a coalition of 38 Mexican and American environmental groups has called for restoration of freshwater flows to the Colorado River Delta and the northern Gulf of California, according to the Tucson-based Southwest Center for Biological Diversity. The groups contend the lack of fresh water has decimated what used to be one of the world's great estuaries. In a November 22nd letter to the Mexican and United States governments, the coalition called for an amendment to the 1944 Colorado River Water Treaty that would permanently allocate water for the conservation and restoration of the Colorado River Delta and the northern Gulf of California. Quote, remnant riverside forests and marshlands still cling to life in the Delta, but are in grave danger of permanent desiccation, the center stated. Ironically, death of the Delta may occur at the hands of the United States Lower Colorado Multi-Species Conservation Program. This program is cynically billed as an endangered species preservation effort, but its written mandate is to maintain and maximize water withdrawals of the infrastructure in the United States. The Lower Colorado Multi-Species Conservation Program is dominated by large water interests from California, Nevada, and Arizona, the coalition charged. Representatives of the Center and Defenders of Wildlife resigned from the steering committee in protest of its refusal to even consider protection for the southwestern willow flycatcher above Hoover Dam or the fragile Delta ecosystem. And we've just received word from the BLM office in Oregon of hearings and appeals that it has ruled in favor on the Harry Thomas timber sale. In other words, we actually won a BLM appeal, according to Greg Dyson. Stopping the logging of 62 acres of old growth, the Harry Thomas sale is located in the heavily logged Thomas Creek, southwest of the Detroit Reservoir in Oregon, the decision read. Although it does not appear that the Harry Thomas timber sale was one of those for which a preliminary injunction was issued by the court, the judgment appears to invalidate the rationale given by the BLM for the decision in this case. And this was referring to the recent ruling by Judge Dwyer about the lack of surveys for endangered species. In view of the judgment of the court finding the action of the BLM in failing to conduct required Category 2 surveys prior to authorizing ground-disturbing activities to be unlawful, it appears that BLM cannot proceed with the sale without taking further action. In these circumstances, we find it appropriate to allow the BLM 30 days from the receipt of this order to show cause why the decision appealed from should not be set aside, the case remanded to allow BLM to take action required to comply with the judgment. That means the BLM has got to do the surveys before they can do the cutting. Consider that Harry Thomas would have been cut last year had we not challenged the sale. We hope to visit the Harry Thomas trees on one of our upcoming monthly hikes. Those are on the second Sunday of each month. Let me know if you'd like to join us. And this message is from Greg Dyson of BARC, and his number 503-331-0374. That's Greg at 503-331-0374. And Y2K problem takes on a different meaning when applied to California's desert parks. New threats to park preservation and integrity seem to abound as we prepare for the calendar change. Perhaps the worst new development is the proposed expansion of the Briggs Mine in the Panamint Mountains, just outside of Death Valley National Park in California. The Briggs Mine, an open-pit gold mining operation on the BLM land, wants to nearly double in size their open pit from 88 acres to 166. Yet the BLM and Briggs have issued an environmental assessment that asserts that the expansion will have no significant impact. The National Park Conservation Association and other environmentalists are concerned that there are significant impacts, such as potential damage to Native American sacred sites, destruction of habitat for native plants and wildlife, including desert bighorn sheep, impacts on water quality and air quality, and harm to the natural and cultural resources of the Death Valley National Park. We believe the current environmental assessment is not adequate and fails to cover the true impacts and alternatives. You can make a comment on the Briggs Mine expansion to George Deverse, D-E-V-E-R-S-E, BLM Ridgecrest Office, 300 South Richmond Road, Ridgecrest, California, 93555. Once again, that address for comments on the Briggs Mine expansion should be sent to George Deverse, D-E-V-E-R-S-E, BLM Ridgecrest Office, 300 South Richmond Road, Ridgecrest, California, 93555. And please have those comments in by January 8th. Tell him that this project warrants a full environmental impact statement. And additionally, the Bureau of Land Management has recently released a draft environmental impact statement detailing a proposal for a groundwater storage project near the Mojave National Preserve. But the document fails to discuss potential impacts to the preserve from this groundwater storage project that would serve as a reservoir and permit Los Angeles to siphon off long-standing groundwater. There's also a draft environmental impact statement on the siting of a high-level nuclear repository near Yucca Mountain, which would draw down and contaminate an aquifer shared by the Death Valley National Park. And from Wisconsin, we read that Oneida County, Wisconsin Judge Mark Mangerson signed a settlement between the citizens of the town of Nashville near Crandon, Wisconsin, and the town's old board members. The old board members, all replaced by election, admitted they had violated Wisconsin's open meeting laws 55 times during the 3 years of closed-door negotiations that led to an agreement with the Nicolet Mining Company. The company needed an agreement with the town before they could get mining permits from the State Department of Natural Resources. As part of the agreement with the town, the mining company paid a large part of the bill for the town's lawyer, Kevin Lyons, who had assured the town that closed meetings were legal and justified. The citizen's attorney is working on a motion asking the judge to, quote, strike down the agreement between the mining company and the town of Nashville on the grounds that the law was broken in the course of reaching it. Nashville's new board is also filing a new lawsuit charging the mining company with fraud and racketeering. Meanwhile, the broad-based protests are occurring to stop the proposed high-voltage transmission line that would feed the Crandon mine. And the dwarf wedge mussel, an endangered mollusk not seen in New Jersey for nearly a century, has been found living in a Delaware River tributary in the northwestern part of the state. Biologists believe that about only 30 waterways in the northeast are home to the inch-long mollusk, which was once common throughout the northeast. The discovery may delay a sewage plant proposed for the stream. According to Jeanette Bowers-Altman, a zoologist for the State Department of Environmental Protection, the dwarf wedge mussel is very sensitive to changes in water quality. The Paulins Kill Bequest Watershed Association local citizens group opposes the new treatment plant on grounds that it may doom the sensitive mollusk beds. The dwarf wedge mussel's last confirmed contact with New Jersey was in 1909 when it was found in the Hackensack River. Biologists attribute its decline to water pollution brought on by agricultural and industrial development. And this is from the New York Times of November 13, 1999. 50 years ago, Aldous Leopold's Ecological Testament, a Sand County Almanac, was published. It was a posthumous book appearing a year and a half after Leopold died of a heart attack in April 1948 at the age of 61. A graduate of the Yale Forestry School and a 17-year veteran of the United States Forest Service, Leopold had his greatest influences during his lifetime as a professor of game management at the University of Wisconsin. But it is the almanac, his meditations on a Wisconsin river farm, and an unequivocal statement of conscience that will carry his influence and his good name down the generations. Leopold's principle and extraordinary contribution to our world was to articulate the idea of a land ethic. The human relation to land, he wrote, is still extremely economic, entailing privileges but not obligations. Leopold believed that the basis of successful conservation was to extend to nature the ethical sense of responsibility that humans extend to each other. This idea has acquired tremendous force since the Sand County Almanac first appeared. The fact that the idea now seems unexceptional is a measure of its widespread influence. 50 years is both a very short and a very long time in the life of a good idea. The power of Leopold's argument, buttressed as it is by his clear, vigorous prose, has not been blunted in the least. In fact, his argument seems more urgently true now than ever before. In the past 50 years, Leopold's work has helped drive the environmental movement, yet the tendencies he lamented, summed up in the phrase, despoilation of the land, have accelerated almost out of control. Leopold will last not because he captured a moment or a feeling, though he does both in the first sections of a Sand County Almanac. He will last because we have scarcely begun to work out the implications of his ideas. He suggested an ecological interpretation of history, which has only recently begun to be written. He recognized that the ability to see a cultural value of wilderness boils down to a question of intellectual humility. And he described the dynamic that still threatens wilderness. The very scarcity of wild places, reacting with the mores of advertising and promotion, tends to defeat any deliberate effort to prevent their growing still more scarce. These are formidable ideas, but none are more challenging than Leopold's land ethic. It requires a rerouting of nature, and that's R-O-O-T-I-N-G, by the way, a forsaking of the hope that we can save wild or even open land on the basis of its economic value. We are busy, Leopold says, inventing subterfuges to give nature economic importance, but they will not work. There is a risk involved in creating a truly ethical relationship to the land, but Leopold believed in risk. Too much safety, he wrote, seems to yield only danger in the long run. And that's a editorial from the New York Times, November 13th, 1999. Well, that's it for Earth First Radio. To get news announcements or comments from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, please send us email at cruzef@cruzio.com. That's C-R-U-Z-E-F at C-R-U-Z-I-O.com, or send letters, donations, CDs, or cassettes to Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Once again, that's Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. And be sure to send those announcements at least 3 weeks in advance. If you'd like more in-depth news and information about the Earth First movement, please subscribe to the Earth First Journal. They're at P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. Once again, that's the Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. Earth First Radio is broadcast live on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, every Thursday evening at 8 p.m., or you can listen to Earth First Radio anytime on your computer on the World Wide Web at radioforall.web.net. That's radioforall, the number 4.web.net. You'll need a sound card in your computer, but the software you need is free on the website. Earth First Radio is being rebroadcast on a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations, and in January we will welcome Berkeley Liberation Radio to our network. If you found us on the web, please ask your local station to download and rebroadcast Earth First Radio. Our theme music was written and performed by Daryl Cherney from the CD Keep It Wild. Earth First Radio is affiliated with the Earth First Radio Network. Parts of tonight's news were prepared by Eon Blues. I'm Uncle Dennis. Thank you for listening, and please tune in again.